This is MIA podcast discussion, Persecution, Resistance, and Flight, Christian Communities in the Modern Middle East, was recorded during the 5th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of the Middle East and Africa in Washington, D.C. on October 12, 2012.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. The topic of discussion today in this panel, of course, is the phenomena of Christian persecution under various Islamic lands, particularly in the Middle East. And the panel with me here today, who I'll introduce later, are all going to discuss various hot spots where this is happening. I myself will discuss the situation for the Coptic Christians of Egypt. But first, I'd like to make some quick introductory remarks to try to put the whole thing into context. I like to bring it back to the Arab Spring, even though what we're going to discuss has been happening for a lot longer. The Arab Spring, ever since it's come about, has become, even though the media originally portrayed it as some sort of democratic movement, and to be sure there was elements of that who apparently got hijacked, but it's becoming more of an Islamic spring, or as others would call it, an Islamic winter, depending on who you talk to. And during this time of the Arab Spring, I like to talk, let's say, starting January 11, the plight of Christian minorities in the various Middle Eastern countries, and really not even just Middle Eastern countries, but anywhere Islamic countries, as far east as Pakistan and into sub-Saharan Africa, especially Nigeria, but other countries, the same sorts of patterns have been coming about of persecution. And it's interesting for me to always try to show that there's a lot of continuity involved in this, and it's not just an aberration. It is an aberration in the modern era, because in the last 150 years or even more, as a lot of Christians under Islam know, it was considered the golden age for Christian minorities, because there was a lot more secularism among Muslims, because it was also the time of colonialism, and there were a lot more freedoms. For example, the jizya, or the tax that Christians had to pay, was abolished in the 19th century. But so now we are returning sort of to a more historical Islam, especially the early Islam. And I like to start by discussing, you're probably, or you may not be familiar with the concept of dhimmitude, which really means the word dhimmi, which is a legal term for non-Muslims who live under Islam. And the dhimmi, there are lots of rules for how they should be governed. And it really begins, according to Islamic scholars and Islamic tradition, with what's called the conditions of Omar, or commonly known as the Pact of Omar, and this would be the second caliph who made that. He made that pact with the conquered Christians of Jerusalem. Other people say it was in Syria. Other people say it wasn't even Omar, it was a later addition. These are scholarly points, but suffice to say, according to Islamic understanding, the Pact of Omar is a pivotal text that dhimmitude, or the laws for dhimmis, were built upon. And the reason I bring it up is because even though this Pact of Omar is believed to have been ratified in the 7th century, and it was added on to later by different caliphs and, of course, the jurists, it makes mention of various items that are still relevant and we are seeing come back today. I'll just discuss two, and I will discuss those two in the context of Egypt, because Egypt, to me, is sort of the paradigm of dhimmitude. And the reason I say that is because Egypt, from a historical point of view, was a primary Christian country. Most people aren't aware that it was really a Christian center, especially Alexandria actually vied with Rome as far as ecclesiastical authority. But when the Islamic conquest happened in the 7th century, and slowly, of course, Christians became minorities, but there's still a large number, and depending on who you ask, there's up to 15 million Christians in Egypt. And so the reason it becomes a paradigm of dhimmitude is because there's so many Christians that you see the sort of laws coming up, because in other countries where there aren't that many, you won't see much of this because they're not there anyway. So the two points I'd like to discuss, or the paradigms, the first one is churches. When you look at the Pact of Omar and the subsequent dhimmi status laws that were built upon it, there's a great focus put on churches. And basically it got distilled down to churches could not be built, new ones, and old ones should be left to crumble away and they're not to be renovated. Now, this, of course, with the vicissitudes of history, sometimes happened in a very dramatic way with lots of destruction, and other times it was more tolerant, and especially, as I was mentioning, during the colonial era or the golden age. But now it's coming back, and I'll just give you a quick list to give you an idea of how this happens. In the Pact of Omar, it specifically states not only can they not be built or renovated, but they should not have visible crosses, there should not be bells or loud singing, because that's offensive to Islam. And so one of the churches a few months ago called Merenib, which is near Edfu in Aswan, was a classic case of this. It was built 100 years ago, and it was so dilapidated that they tried to fix it, the cops, and they actually got a permit for it. Local Muslims were not happy with this, and they started saying things like, we don't want to see a church on it, the dome needs to be taken down. Make a long story short, after Friday prayers, as often is the time when Muslim mobs will go and attack, they came and destroyed that church. And in fact, that was the one church that caused, you may know, the Mespiro massacre. Because after that church was destroyed, cops in mass protested, because this was not the first church, of course. A few months earlier, there was a church in Seoul, and it was an ancient church. And Muslims went up with sledgehammers, destroyed it completely, raised it to the ground, spent 10 hours doing that. Police forces didn't do anything. And Maranup, that church in Edfu, was done again in very classical doctrine, because you're not supposed to renovate it, you're not supposed to put a cross, you're not supposed to have bells. And Muslims took the law in their own hands in that region. As for the Church of Seoul, that also has precedent. It was in the precedent, or the pretext for why it was attacked, was because in the region a Coptic Christian man was accused of having a relationship with a Muslim woman. And that too is part of the Dhimma law, which means Christian men cannot marry Muslim women. And so it was part of a collective punishment. Because of that fact, Muslims rose, destroyed that church. Then there was the Imbaba churches, or the Imbaba riots a few months before that. And in this case, two or three churches were attacked and burned. And again, there was some pretext that wasn't even real. The pretext basically was that apparently some Coptic girl wanted to convert to Islam, and cops were preventing her. So Muslims rioted, destroyed three churches, and some Christians were killed. Then, of course, there's the New Year's attack. You may remember that. That's the one that actually made it to the mainstream media, where during midnight mass, the Church of Two Saints was attacked, 23 people killed. All of this happened right around the time of the Arab Spring, by the way. But it's also been happening before that, but it's coming back now with a passion. The other aspect that's very important is that while we can say under Mubarak, churches were attacked, because they have been, since the probably 1970s, hundreds have been attacked in Egypt. But there's a new theme that also traces back to the Dhimma laws and the Pact of Omar, which is this new idea of blasphemy codes. In Egypt now, whereas under Mubarak's reign, there were very, very minimal rare cases of Christians being accused of blasphemy, which is to say insulting or offending Muhammad. Today, there is approximately 17 cases. There were 18 cases, and this has all happened ever since Mubarak was ousted, and basically under Muslim Brotherhood auspices. Of the 18 cases, 17 of them are Christians. One was a Muslim, and he was exonerated. The other 17 are all either in jail or pending or waiting. One, for instance, was a pregnant woman who basically said something, and it was interpreted. A pregnant woman teacher who teaching said Prophet Muhammad, but she didn't finish it up by saying in Arabic, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, which is basically peace and blessings upon him. This was construed as blasphemy, and because she's pregnant, she was left alone until she delivers the baby, and then she may well be tried. Another case was a teacher who on his Facebook account put something that was deemed insulting to Muhammad. He got 6 years. Another case, 17-year-old student. On his Facebook, he only has 130 friends. 130 friends, he put something, it was discovered, he got 3 years in jail. And there's a lot more cases of this. And they're not unlike, you may have heard in Pakistan, the Rimsha case, the young Pakistani girl that was accused of tearing up a Quran. Same identical thing happened a couple of weeks ago. Two little Coptic boys, I think 9 and 10, were accused of tearing up a Quran. Turned out that they're illiterate. They don't even know what the book was. It was in the garbage and it was already torn up. And there were riots and people wanted them arrested or worse. And it's important to keep in mind that whereas the churches, they're getting worse, the attacks on churches, and that this has a lot of continuity with Islamic history and tradition and doctrine, this blasphemy thing is very much a reflection of the new rule in Egypt, which is basically with the Islamization of Egypt and with the rise and prominence of the Salafis and, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. Blasphemy, like I said, under Mubarak was not a prominent issue. You had a rare case every few years. Now, in a few months, we've already got 17. So the issue is obviously there. It's a real thing. Of course, the problem is the mainstream is not aware of it because these topics rarely make it into the mainstream. And when they do, they're sort of watered down. I remember, for instance, the New Year's Eve church bombing where 23 people were killed. You know, it's 23 church, middle of the night, worshiping. It was bombed, 23 people dead. And the New York Times headline was basically Muslims and Christians riot and clash. Sectarian strife. So you read it and you get the impression that basically, well, it's an equal kind of conflict. And that's not the case at all. And of course, we're going to hear now from other people about different regions, who I'll be introducing shortly. And I think it's important to keep in mind as you listen to them that I'm talking about Egypt. They're going to talk about other countries, Iraq, Iran, and elsewhere. And it's interesting to note the parallels, the things that you will see. So what's happening in Iraq and Iran will be what's happening in Egypt. And it's even worse than that. You can leave the Arab world, go to Nigeria. Churches are probably daily attacked there by Boko Haram or Western Education as a sin, a militant Islamic jihadi group. Go far into Pakistan, same exact thing. So these patterns are not aberrations, they're not cultural issues. They have a long tradition and they trace back to something else. And I think that's the big picture. At this point, I'd like to introduce our first panelist, Juliana Taimurazi. She's an Assyrian Christian born in Iran, and she fled Iran and received asylum eventually. And she's the founder of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council, who helps try to empower various Christian minorities in Iraq and elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Good afternoon. It is truly an honor for me to be among such esteemed scholars. My name is Juliana Taimurazi, and I'm an Assyrian Christian. I was born in a country that is famous for its poets, Hafez and Omar Khayyam. I was born in Iran. I grew up despising my Catholic name because my teachers told me that I would burn in hell for carrying this Christian name. Starting in 1979, when the new Islamic regime took control of the country, things changed drastically for the worst for all the Assyrians and Armenian Christians. Our neighbors, actually, whom we lived next to, for many years started calling us najis, unclean. Boys in our neighborhood started spitting on the ground as I passed by them. My classmates gradually started distancing themselves from me. In middle school, there were students who would shout at me and would try to force me to recite a verse from the Quran, which would convert me to Islam. I was treated as a heretic, a third-class citizen, someone without any dignity. All of this began only when I was 12 years old. I endured this cruel discrimination until the age of 16, when my family sold 35 years of heirlooms and belongings to pay a smuggler to help me get smuggled out of Iran. I was smuggled out of two countries, Iran and Switzerland, to Germany, where in the American embassy, I declared the religious asylum and became a refugee. However, what I endured is an insignificant fraction of what my Assyrian nation has experienced in Iraq. The Assyrians, also known as Chaldeans and Syriacs, are without a doubt the indigenous people of today's Iraq. They have lived in their ancestral homeland, tracing their roots back to Sumerians and Akkadians, who settled in Mesopotamia approximately 4,000 years before Christ, contributing to civilization through the inception of the first library, creation of the first code of law, discovering the practice of herbal medicine. Assyrians are the first nation to convert to Christianity through the evangelization of St. Thomas in the first century AD, and we still speak Aramaic or Neo-Aramaic. The religious and ethnic cleansing are two very familiar scars in my nation's history. In 1914, two powers, Kurds and Turks, on a united front, targeted the innocent Assyrians in the northern part of both Iraq and Iran. Children died in their mothers' arms while fleeing their villages. Men's skulls placed on stakes bid their families farewell, and women were repeatedly raped by their adversaries. My own great-grandmother was kidnapped by the Kurds. My own great-uncle was killed and cut into pieces by Iranian Muslims and sent back in a rice bag to his wife. The following images may be graphic. From 2003 until now, in a land that we Assyrians call our ancestral homeland, series of gruesome and systematic attacks have been perpetrated against the defenseless Chaldeo-Assyrian nation. We now know that these attacks were orchestrated and carried out mainly by our enemies outside the borders of Iraq. Christian families were given really three choices: to convert to Islam, to pay jizya, or to leave. Or if they disobey, they would die. Men who did not follow such orders were kidnapped, tortured, and many of them murdered. Our women were kidnapped, raped, and sent back impregnated. Our infants were kidnapped. This next image is graphic. And held for ransom, and on many occasions either killed or thrown in garbage bins in remote parts of Baghdad. The Christian churches have been bombed over 80 times. Our clergy were spat on, thrown mud at. This is Father Raghid Ghani, who had just returned from the Vatican to Mosul, along with his three deacons, where they were viciously slaughtered in front of his church right after Mass. The Chaldean Archbishop Farah Drahu was kidnapped for the second time in February of 2008, and his body was found on the side of the road on March 13, 2008, and he was killed by poisoning through his nostrils. They had poured acid in his nose. Our students have been continuously harassed and on many occasions murdered throughout Iraq. On May 2, 2010, four buses carrying Christian students on their way to Mosul University were attacked. Two people died and the rest were injured, 58 of them badly, 9 of them have lost their eyes. They were on their way to take their final exam. Each and every attack against Christians in Iraq is an attack against the entire Christian family throughout the world. On October 31st, 2010, when Our Lady of Salvation Cathedral came under attack in Baghdad, 8 Islamic men, one as young as 14 from Yemen, stormed the church, killing 2 priests while injuring the third. In an interview with Asia News, an eyewitness recalls in fear, quote, "One terrorist was wounded and kept on saying to his leader, 'I'm hurt, I'll detonate the explosive so I can become a martyr and go straight to heaven.' His commander gave him the permission and bade each other farewell, saying, 'Okay, see you in heaven.' Then he blew himself up. His companions then began shouting, 'You are unbelievers. You will go to hell while we are going to heaven. God is great. Allahu Akbar.'" This is an actual Christian who has been killed. The same eyewitness laments, "Father Thaher, the priest who celebrated Mass, died because he wanted to save the children. Father Wasim, who at the time of the attacks was at the confessional, in the confessional, tried to talk with the terrorists to let the people go. They shot him as well. The last sentence, Father Thaher, who died before the eyes of his mother, who is now survived, was, 'Jesus, into thy hands I commend my spirit.' He, representing the love of Christ, was dressed in a beautiful white and blue vestment, demonstrating the peace and glory, while the Islamists wore a bomb vest. And now, where are those Christians that once were described by their Iraqi Muslim brothers and sisters as the scent of the flower, Iraq being the flower itself? What became of the same people which the Quran refers to as people of the book? Over 900,000 Christians have fled their homes and have become refugees. Today, we have approximately 450,000 only left in Iraq, in their ancestral homeland. What I just illustrated to you all represent the despicable acts of religious cleansing. My nation is also faced with ethnic cleansing perpetrated by the Kurds in Iraq. As recent as just 2 weeks ago, the Kurdish regional government has sent their agents to forcefully claim the lands which lawfully belong to the Assyrians in the north. They have gone in there and have taken over the farms, and people cannot work anymore. This is a form of ethnic cleansing, and no one has stopped them to date. As I mentioned before, I was born in Iran. When I was growing up in Tehran, dozens of my friends chose to leave the country in the hopes of a better future in the West. There were approximately 100,000 Assyrians who lived in Iran in 1970s and 80s. Today, we have less than 10,000 left. Assyrians, although they're welcomed, and they're really not murdered or slaughtered for their faith in Iran, They're able to attend weekly mass and learn about their Aramaic language in churches. However, one must not ignore the fact that they are living as second or third class citizens. Yes, they are living as second or third class citizens. I know, because I was one of them. Every day, Iranian Christians are discriminated against. According to reports from several Christian organizations, there's a large underground church forming in Iran, despite all the threats from the government. This has led to arrest and killing of many men and women who have converted from Islam to Christianity. In close, I ask the human rights activists to continue to keep the plight of the Christians of Iraq and Iran on the policymakers' radars. We do not want Christian ghettos in the Middle East. We need a free society to practice our religion. I am standing here before you as a messenger. I am the voice of those who are voiceless. How long will we stand on the sidelines, silently, watching the Iraqi Christians endure such horror and dignity be stripped away from the Iranian Christians? Next time, when you hear Ode to Joy of Beethoven, when you listen to the chorus singing Friedrich Schiller's lyrics, Alle Menschen werden Brüder, all men become brothers, remember that these lines are speaking of humanity and solidarity. Even if there are those of you who do not believe in organized religion, to you, this should symbolize the pure spirit of brotherhood under one creator, the creator we may call the light, Allah, God, Adonai, or Allah. Thank you.
Thank you, Juliana. Our next speaker is Emel Maroghi. Emel has a PhD in Oriental Languages and Cultures, is an Iraqi Chaldean and a bilingual Neo-Aramaic Arabic speaker who teaches Arabic and Arabic linguistics at the University of Cambridge. And she works as an active contributor to the intercultural dialogue between the East and West.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for allowing me to talk to you this afternoon. As a Chaldean Christian, I'm going to talk about something important which has been important to me and I've been thinking a lot about. And as you know, we've just been made aware of the suffering that affected Christian community in Iraq. It didn't only result in killing innocent people, their displacement and the loss of their property and the future, and their uprooting from their natural habitat where they have been fighting for their survival for the last 14 centuries. Today, I'd like to bring to your attention what may be described as a thorn in the side of the Christian community, and especially in the Chaldean community in Iraq, and what I call, you know, the lost generation, both among the Christian communities back in Iraq and in the diaspora. The Chaldean community in Iraq has been characterized by its significant contribution to the cultural and intellectual life. But as the result of instability and their forced displacement, the intellectual elite has been caught up in a struggle for survival and the challenge of finding themselves unable to bridge the intellectual and cultural chasm that started to separate them from their children, and their children's world. They have suddenly found themselves faced with the mammoth task of handing on their heritage, which has been associated with so much pain, and freeing their children from any shackle that clings them to the past. The struggle for survival of the members of the community, both in Iraq and in the diaspora, drove them to neglect their indispensable role as the missing link between the East and the West, and deprive them from being active contributors to the intellectual life and the political and social debates wherever they are living. I hope I'm not exaggerating by saying that both the East and the West have failed to find a common ground and common language to open a channel of true, honest, and constructive dialogue. And I dare say that as long as Christians in the Middle East, and the Chaldeans in particular, remain absent from the intellectual, cultural, and political arenas, the clash of civilization will continue to be a true threat. What is more, the community's ability to preserve their collective memory and their rich and their rich cultural and linguistic heritage without any sectarian prejudice has been considerably weakened. It is not enough to create political parties and have elections. It is not enough to have a change or even a revolution. What is needed, what is urgently needed, is education and a wise leadership with a vision. True change will not happen through evolution or through revolution, but through evolution. We need a leadership that's immersed in the true principles of freedom, tolerance, and respect for human rights and the right of each individual to identify himself or herself in accordance with their cultural and ethnic heritage. In Iraq, the word Chaldean was prohibited under Saddam. And I remember being a child when they will ask you about your ethnic origin. You write Arabic and they will just cross it and they will write, you write Chaldean and they will cross it and they will write Arabic. And I remember a teacher of mine asking, when I was arguing with a teacher of mine and asking her why she was changing my ethnic identity. And she said, but there are no Chaldeans in Iraq. You are all Arabs. And of course, you know, like when you're a child, you know, like at the age of 11 or 12, you cannot contradict your teacher, but that is what happened. And so we didn't exist, basically. And I remember looking in some encyclopedias, you know, for Chaldeans, and we didn't exist. We were not on the map. And this is what happened. And sometimes we still have to struggle for our existence as there are attempts to erase our identity still today. And it is good to remember that my identity is not an oppressive tool of fighting against the other, but a responsibility to serve the other. And this is part of my Chaldean identity. However, my diagnosis for the situation is lack of education. Every individual, and more so in communities whose very existence is threatened, needs formation in freedom, democracy, and in ethics to reach the end that is stability and happiness. How we judge things is not predetermined, and to have good intentions is not enough. We need education and formation of character. We have many specialists who are offering therapies, but they forget that we are dealing with human beings with free will, and what we need in the first place is education. That's why I've decided to create the Aradin Educational Trust for the study of Christian culture and heritage in the Middle East. The aim of this trust is to grant, is a small grant-making body that aims to encourage education and raise public awareness of the dangers facing ancient Christian communities in the Middle East, and especially in Iraq, of irreparable loss to their cultural and linguistic heritage. These communities are not only heirs and bearers of ancient languages and cultures, but have also been the first Christians to enter into a peaceful and fruitful intercultural and religious dialogue with Islam. The main objectives of this trust is to empower scholars and researchers in their communities, in these communities, to achieve excellence in research. Through cooperation with different British, American, and European academic institutions, the center aims to provide all the necessary training and financial help in accordance with the individual academic and practical needs of the grantee. We would like also to encourage local female researchers in particular to play an active role and achieve international recognition through excellent scholarly output. Special attention will be paid to helping them produce academic monographs and articles. It's also to encourage and study the ancient endangered languages, such as the various dialects of Neo-Aramaic and Syriac, in addition to Arabic, especially among scholars, members of Christian communities in the diaspora. The center will be organizing short and tailored courses to help researchers master these languages effectively in a short time. In this way, we aim to help revive these languages that face real danger of extinction or radical lexical and structural changes through intensive language contact with the languages of these peoples in new homelands. Finally, we would like to help researchers in the Middle East to document and conserve their neglected local heritage that does not benefit from local, national, or international support or recognition, such as centuries-old churches, houses, private manuscripts, and artifacts. And just to finish, we have in my village, we have a church that dates back to the 4th century. And I've just discovered while I was asking a few people in my in my family that it turned out that there is another church which actually probably will be a little bit earlier than that church, which dates back to the 4th century. I mean, that church is well known to be as old, but it seems that we still have the main altar and the main part of the church dates back what they know as before Islam. And this is something I didn't know. I remember being a child and going to that church, but of course there's nothing documented, nothing known about these gems, really, the hidden gems that we have there and which are threatened. So this is my aim, and I hope that I can serve our Christian communities by helping them to educate themselves and to educate our children so that we can keep our heritage alive. Thank you.
Thank you, Emil. Our next speaker is Frank Salama, and he is an assistant professor of Near Eastern Studies at Boston College and author of Language, Memory, and Identity in the Middle East, The Case for Lebanon, 2010. Frank.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Thank you, everyone. I think I'm going to depart a little bit from the format of my colleagues here, and I'm going to, my paper addresses the issue of political apathy vis-a-vis the plight of Near Eastern Christians. And since I would like to stay within my allotted 10 minutes, what I'm going to do is read you my conclusion. My conclusion is taken from, it's a quote, it's a large quote, it's about a 10-minute quote, from Armenian-American author William Saroyan. I don't know if anyone heard of him. You will hear of him today. Yes. He wrote this short story, published this short story in 1933, titled 70,000 Assyrians. And it's a story that we read. I teach a course on minorities in the Middle East, and this is one of the short stories that we read. By the way, I try to read three books a year, the same three books. I try to read them at least once a year. Le Petit Prince is one of them, The Little Prince, Night is another one, and 70,000 Assyrians is the third. It was written 80 years ago. As I said, it's a statement on political apathy, but it might have been written yesterday or 8 days ago or 80 days ago or 800 years ago. Because what we're dealing with when it comes to Near Eastern Christians, I think, and he thinks, is apathy more than anything else. And it's a very powerful statement. I compare it to Martin Niemöller's statement on the Nazi crimes. But of course, Saroyan wrote this a few years before Niemöller's statement. You know which one I'm talking about. First they came for the communists. Saroyan begins by telling us how it's been ages since he's got a haircut. He said he was beginning to look seedy and dirty, like several violinists out of work and ready to join the Communist Party. So he goes to the San Francisco Barbers College for a 15-cent haircut. So that sort of tells you it's, what era we're talking about. So he goes to the San Francisco Barbers College, and he lands himself a new apprentice. And here's what happens next. The young man who gave me the haircut was tall. He had a dark, serious face, thick lips on the verge of smiling, but melancholy, thick eyelashes, sad eyes, a large nose. I saw his name on the card that was pasted on the mirror. Theodore Bedal, it said. A good name, genuine, a good young man, genuine. Theodore Bedal began working on my head. A good barber never speak unless he's spoken to, no matter how full his heart is. That name, I said, Bedal, are you an Armenian? I'm an Armenian. I've mentioned this before. People look at me and begin to wonder, so I come right out and tell them, I'm an Armenian, I say. Or they might read something I've written and begin to wonder, so I let them know, I'm an Armenian, I say. It's a meaningless remark, but they expect me to say it, so I do. I have no idea what it's like to be an Armenian, or what it's like to be an Englishman or a Japanese or anything else. I have a faint idea of what it's like to be alive. This is the only thing that interests me greatly, this and tennis. I hope someday to write a great philosophical work on tennis, something on the order of death in the afternoon, but I'm aware that I'm not ready yet to undertake such a project. It may seem to some sophisticated people that I'm trying to make fun of Hemingway. I'm not. Death in the Afternoon is a pretty sound piece of prose. Even when Hemingway is a fool, he's at least an accurate fool. Are you an Armenian, I say? We're a small people, and whenever one of us meets another, it's an event. We're always looking around for someone to talk in our language. Our most ambitious political party estimates that there are nearly 2 million of us living on Earth. But most of us don't think so. Most of us sit down and take a pencil and a piece of paper, and we take one section of the world at a time and imagine how many Armenians, at the most, are likely to be living in that section. And we put the highest number on paper, and then we go on to another section, India, Russia, Soviet Armenia, Egypt, Italy, Germany, France, America, South America, etc. And after we add up our most hopeful figures, the total comes to something a little less than 1 million. Then we start to think how big our families are, and how high our birth rate, and how low our death rate, except in times of war, when massacres increase our death rate. And we begin to imagine how rapidly we will increase if we are left alone, even for a quarter century. And we feel happy about that. I remember the Near East relief drive in my hometown. My uncle used to be our speaker, and he used to make the whole auditorium full of Armenians weep. He was an attorney, and he was a great speaker. Well, at first, the trouble was war. Our people were being destroyed by the enemy. Those who hadn't been killed were homeless, and they were starving. Our flesh and blood, my uncle said, and we all wept. And we gathered money and sent it out to our people in the old country. Then after the war, when I was a bigger boy, we had another Near East relief drive. And my uncle stood on the stage of the civic auditorium of my hometown, and he said, "Thank God this time it's not the enemy, it's an earthquake. God has made us suffer. We have worshipped him through trial and tribulation, through suffering and disease and torture and horror." And my uncle began to weep. He began to sob. "We've worshipped him through the madness of despair, and now he has done this thing. And still we praise him. Still we worship him. We don't understand the ways of God." And after the drive, I went to my uncle and I said, Did you mean what you said about God? He said, "That was oratory, son. We've got to raise money. What God? God is nonsense." "And when you cried," I asked, and my uncle said, "That was real. I could not help it. I had to cry. Why? For God's sake, why must we go through this goddamn hell? Why? What have we done to deserve all this torture? Man won't leave us alone. God won't leave us alone. Have we done something wrong? Aren't we supposed to be a pious people? What is our sin? I'm disgusted with God. I'm sick of man. The only reason I'm willing to get up and talk is that I don't dare keep my mouth shut anymore. I can't bear the thought of more of our people dying. Jesus Christ, have we done something wrong?" So I asked Theodore Bedal, "Are you an Armenian?" He said, "I'm an Assyrian." Well, that's something. The Assyrians came from the same part of the world as us. They had noses like our noses, eyes like our eyes, hearts like our hearts. They had a different language. When they spoke, we couldn't understand them, but they were a lot like us. It wasn't quite as pleasing as it would have been had Badal been an Armenian, but that was really something, an Assyrian. "I'm an Armenian," I said. "I used to know some Assyrians from my hometown, Joseph Sarkis, Nito Elia, Tony Saleh. Do you know any of them?" "Joe Sarkis, I know him. The others I don't. We lived in New York until 5 years ago. Then we came out to Turlock, and then we moved up to San Francisco. We began to talk about the Assyrian language and the Armenian language, about the old world, conditions over there, and so on. I was getting a 15-cent haircut, and I was doing my utmost best to learn something at the same time, to acquire some new truth, some new appreciation of the wonder of life, the dignity of man. Man has great dignity, you know. Do not imagine he does not. Badal said, I can't read Assyrian. I was born in the old country, but I want to get over it. He sounded tired, not physically, but spiritually tired. Why, I said, why do you want to get over it? Well, he laughed, simply because everything is washed up over there. I'm repeating his words precisely, putting in nothing of my own. We were a great people once, he went on, but that was yesterday, the day before yesterday. Now we are a topic in ancient history. We had a great civilization. They're still admiring it. Now I'm in America, learning how to cut hair. We're washed up as a race. We're through. It's all over. Why should I learn to read the language? We have no writers. We have no news. Well, there's a little news. Once in a while, the English encouraged the Arabs to slaughter us, and that's that. It's an old story. We know it all too well. Anyway, these remarks were very painful to me. An Armenian, I had always felt badly about my own people being destroyed. I had never heard an Assyrian speaking in English about such things. I felt great love for this young fellow. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a tendency these days to think in terms of pansies whenever a man says that he has affection for another man. I think now I have affection for all people, even for the enemies of Armenia, whom I have so tactfully not named. Everyone knows who they are. I've nothing against any of them because I think of them as one man living one life at a time, and I know, I'm positive, that one man at a time is incapable of the monstrosities performed by mobs. My objection is to mobs only. Well, I said, it's much the same with us. We too are old. We still have our church. We still have our writers, Aharonian, Ishakian, a few others. But it's much the same, like you. Yes, said the barber, I know. We went in for the wrong things. We went in for the simple things, peace and quiet and families. We didn't go in for machinery and conquest and militarism. We didn't go in for diplomacy and deceit and the invention of machine guns and poison gas. Oh, well, there's no use in being disappointed. We had our day, I suppose. We are hopeful, I said. There is no Armenian living who doesn't still dream of an independent Armenia. Dream, said Badal. Well, that's something. Assyrians can't even dream anymore. Why, do you know how many of us are left on Earth? 2-3 million, I said. 70,000, said Badal. That's all. 70,000 Assyrians in the world, and the Arabs are still killing us. They killed 70 of us in a little uprising last month. There was a small paragraph in the paper. 70 more of us destroyed. We'll be wiped out before long. My brother is married to an American girl, and he has a son. There's no more hope. We're trying to forget Assyria. My father still reads an Assyrian paper that comes from New York, but he's an old man. He will be dead soon. Then his voice changed. He ceased speaking as an Assyrian, and he began to speak as a barber. Have I taken enough off the top? He asked. The rest of the story is meaningless. I said so long to the young Assyrian, and I left the shop. I thought about this whole business, Assyria and the Assyrians, Theodore Badal learning to be a barber, the sadness of his voice, the hopelessness of his attitude. This was months ago, in August. But ever since, I've been thinking about Assyria, and I've been wanting to say something about Theodore Bedal, the son of an ancient race, himself youthful and alert, yet hopeless. 70,000 Assyrians, a mere 70,000 of that great people, and all the others quiet in death, and all the greatness crumbled and ignored, and a young man in America learning to be a barber, and a young man lamenting bitterly the course of history. I'm thinking of 70,000 Assyrians, one at a time, alive, a great race. I'm thinking of Theodore Bedal himself, 70,000 Assyrians and 70 million Assyrians, himself Assyria and man, standing in a barbershop in San Francisco in 1933, being still himself, the whole Assyrian race. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Our next speaker is Dwight Bashir. He's a deputy director for policy and research at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, an independent federal advisory board which monitors religious freedom conditions worldwide and makes recommendations for U.S. policy. And he'll be speaking to us a little bit about just that. Dwight.
Thank you very much, Raymond. Thanks for having me this afternoon. I know it's been a long day, I'm sure, first day of the conference, but it's a pleasure to be here and address you this afternoon. I think the stage was kind of set by my colleagues here on the panel regarding the plight of Christians in the Middle East and North Africa. I want to start, though, first by saying a little bit about religious freedom in the region and talk about where the commission came from and what this apparatus does. And just to give you a little context, back in the 1990s, there was a coalition, interreligious coalition that worked together. They were concerned about the plight of Christians all over the world, actually, not just in the Middle East. And they advocated the U.S. government to do something, the Clinton administration. And the response was, we're happy to address that, but not just Christians. We want to look at religious freedom or freedom of religion for all people in the world, which would track with international human rights standards. So a body was set up at the State Department initially for a couple of years, and then in 1998, the International Religious Freedom Act was passed, which basically created an office at the State Department called the Office of International Religious Freedom in the Bureau of Human Rights, and it created our commission, an independent body, an advisory body. It was also supposed to have a position at the National Security Council, the White House, an advisory role there to advise the president directly. That never actually came to fruition. There's a larger position there, a director that deals with democracy and humanitarian assistance and so on, that deals with religious freedom as well. The long and short is an annual report is put out every year in addition to the Human Rights Report, which some of you may be familiar with, but there's a Religious Freedom Report that's been put out for almost 15 years now. Our commission focuses on those countries that are most considered most severe violators of religious freedom. And our main statutory mandate is to make recommendations to the White House and State Department on what countries should qualify as a, quote, country of particular concern for egregious, systematic, and ongoing violations. When you look at that list, there are eight countries on this list that the State Department recommends. We actually recommend 16. And it's twice as much. And as you can appreciate, the State Department has a lot of strategic interests to deal with. So religious freedom is not necessarily up there on the totem pole in terms of priorities. And this has been a constant from the beginning under the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and currently the Obama administration. The reality is there's been a lot of good rhetoric and actually better rhetoric. I will say in this administration, and we'll kind of narrow it here to the Middle East region. With regard to minorities, and in particular Christians, I think you've seen some rhetoric that's improved from the president in various speeches, whether it was his Cairo speech in 2009 to the addressing the Muslim world, or a Middle East policy speech last May. He did address these issues. He addressed religious freedom. He referred to the Copts in Egypt. He referred to Maronites. He referred to various groups and has put out some statements. But that's just the point. I mean, at some point, rhetoric is important. Obviously, from the highest bully pulpit you have, the President of the United States. But if that rhetoric is not backed up by policy action on the ground, whether it's through our embassies in these countries or the levers that exist, already exist. Now, with that legislation I talked about in 1998, if you get put on that severe list, there are repercussions. It's not just you're on a blacklist and that's what it is. There are policy tools that are invoked at that point, all the way up to economic sanctions. To a démarche, government to government démarche, there's a toolkit. The reality at this point is that there's only one country that had been given specific sanctions for religious freedom violations, and that's Eritrea in Africa. And when it was put on the list in 2004, the Bush administration actually imposed the sanction. But other countries that are on that list in the region, for example, Iran, Saudi Arabia are on the list. Iran, they're kind of double-hatting sanctions that have existed, meaning sanctions that already existed for involvement in terrorism, et cetera, from the previous Clinton administration were basically pushed forward. And there was no specific other sanction that was put forward. Saudi Arabia, 2004, was named a country of particular concern. And for the past 8 years, they've gotten a waiver for the interest of the act. That's always the out. You can get a waiver for being on this list. So if you're going to put a country on the list and you're going to waive any kind of action, it kind of flies in the face of the first place. However, one thing that I think the Bush administration did in the second term was in the national security. Platform, that the national security strategy, it included religious freedom as an important element there, not just saying human rights are important, but it specifically talked about religious freedom. And then we saw further the Bush freedom agenda, and Condoleezza Rice said a few words in Cairo in 2005. I'm rewinding again just to say that we saw good language on these issues 7 years ago, 3 years ago. So the question is, what needs to happen? Because I think Raymond was right. I mean, you don't see it in the mainstream press. If you follow these issues, you can find it. It's out there. There are media entities, there are NGOs that get the information out. And, in my position, I'm looking at the Middle East and North Africa and religious freedom. So I'm hearing it. I'm seeing it. But if you're relying on wire reports or the New York Times or the Washington Post or Fox News or CNN, you're not going to really see it, and it's happening every day. And just to give you a sense, at the beginning of the 20th century, over 20% of the population of the Middle East and North Africa was Christian. Today, less than 10% of the population is Christian. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. It's not just because of persecution. It's not just because of rise of extremism. There are other reasons. However, I think it's important to keep in mind that unless you have some kind of entity that's not only going to advocate and speak out, but that there'll be repercussions. I think one thing we're seeing in the international community, the United Nations, is those individuals who are tasked with reporting on freedom of religion or other human rights are speaking out and calling for specific releases of individuals, which you really hadn't seen in years previously. That's an important tool to use. And President Obama did that last year. And I'm referring to the case of Iran, Yusuf Nadarkhani, a well-known case, a pastor in Iran who was imprisoned, sentenced to death by hanging in 2010 in Iran. And his case arose to the highest levels of the media, the President of the United States, the international community. And he was just released last month after being in prison for almost 3 years and had a death sentence on his head. And had there not been that kind of advocacy and attention in the media, could he have been killed? Very possibly. We saw that with a number of other minorities in the country, like the Baha'is of Iran. Over 200 leaders of that minority in Iran were executed in the 1980s and 90s. So I think, that's a very important tool to use, is the bully pulpit. But beyond that, there need to be repercussions, because in Syria we see today, I mean, this is the vexing question. This was a country where Christians, and I was one to say years ago, where it was really a haven for minorities and Christians. I mean, a lot of the Iraqi refugees a good number of Christians came into Syria when they fled after things were getting really bad after 2003. And now we see today that there's serious uncertainty and real concern about that population there. So I think the reality is, when it comes to human rights and specifically freedom of religion, there are limited tools, because when you're talking about security, you're talking about terrorism. We're already at a standstill with a country like Syria, where people are being killed. More than 20,000 people are being killed for a number of different reasons, and yet it continues. So when you're talking about minorities that are affected, there are limited things that can be done. However, one other thing I want to talk about, which I don't think the United States and the international community is doing enough on, is trying to influence constitutions that are being either rewritten or drafted from scratch right now. We see that in Egypt, we're seeing it in Tunisia, we're going to see it in Libya, we're seeing it in a number of countries. Even Turkey is revisiting. I know it's not in the MENA region per se, but there are a number of countries that are looking at this, and we've seen a draft of the Egypt constitution, and it doesn't look that good when you're talking about minorities. Now, they protect the heavenly religions in that country by constitution, but what about others outside the flock there? So I think, while focusing on the persecution of Christians, it's a real issue, it's a real concern, it's a serious issue that needs more attention, not only by the U.S. government, but the international community, but we should be looking out protecting freedom of religion or belief for all. There is value to that. Because in different countries where you might, even outside the region, there are groups that don't kind of fit within the traditional, Abrahamic faith, let's say, and they can be at great risk. So since I think I've already hit my allotted time, I'll stop there, but I hope we can go further in the questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Dwight. I just think this was a great panel. Had a lot of various topics, but they're all somehow interrelated.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To become an ASMEA member or to learn more about ASMEA, please visit us online at asmeascholars.org. That's ASMEA scholars.org.